You're listening to the Triangle Radio Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the November 2018 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Here's the continuation of the 2018 New Establishment List. 82, Bonnie Hammer, age 68, occupation, chair, NBC Universal Cable, previous rank, 65, the queen of cable. Hammer is set to become possibly the longest-reigning female executive in TV history. And Steve Burke and Brian Roberts will increasingly rely on her as NBCU fights for terrain in a landscape dominated by Netflix, Amazon, and Bob Iger's latest land grab. 83, James Murdoch, age 45, occupation, outgoing CEO, 21st Century Fox, previous rank, 56. Alone in the world, the admired and respected Murdoch, who bears a resemblance to the Kendall Roy character in HBO's Succession, has been tight-lipped about his next act after the Disney deal closes and he exits the family business. The pervasive assumption is a new investment vehicle of his own design. 84. Katrina Lake. Age, 35. Occupation, CEO, Stitch Fix. Previous rank, 99. The clothes make the boss. When Lake's tech retail company Stitch Fix held an IPO in November 2017, she became the youngest female founder to take a company public. 85. Donald Glover, age 35. Occupation, actor, director, musician, and he's new to these rankings. Renaissance man. In 2018, Glover was master of multiple pop cultural domains. He starred in the movie Solo, nabbed 16 Emmy nominations for his TV series Atlanta, and hit number one on Billboard's Hot 100 chart with This Is America. 86. The Talking Heads, Rachel Maddow, Chris Cuomo, Anderson Cooper, Don Lemon, Nicole Wallace, Jake Tapper, Shep Smith. Ages 45, 48, 51, 52, 46, 49, and 54. Occupations, cable news anchors, and they are new to these rankings. Little screen bigwigs, if cable news personalities are the celebrities of the Trump era, these are a red carpet murderer's row. 87. Nancy Dubuque, age 49. Occupation, CEO, Vice. Previous rank, 88. The professional, as Vice co-founder Shane Smith stepped back from the day-to-day, Dubuque was brought in to tame the wilds of the company's corporate culture and make sure its hashtag MeToo problems, not to mention revenue issues, are fixed. 88. Stuart Butterfield, age 45, occupation, CEO, Slack, previous rank, 89. The only person everyone actually likes, the unofficial nice guy of Silicon Valley, Butterfield sits at the helm of a now ubiquitous workplace messaging company. This year, Slack was valued at $7.1 billion. 89. Chris Meledandri, age 59, occupation, CEO, Illumination, previous rank, 68. Evidence of tween world domination, the producer and Illumination founder and CEO has a hand in several animated film franchises, Ice Age, Despicable Me, Minions, The Secret Life of Pets, and now Seeing, with sequels for the latter three currently underway. Despicable Me 3 alone brought in more than $1 billion worldwide last year. 90. The Collision Brothers, ages 30, Patrick, 28, John, occupations, founders, Stripe, previous rank, 84. Ireland's greatest export. It took less than 8 years for the software developed by the Collision Brothers, who grew up in County Limerick, to become the $9.2 billion payment platform of choice for everyone in Silicon Valley. 91. Channing Dungey, age 49, occupation, president, ABC Entertainment. And she's new to these rankings. No holds barred. The first African-American woman to head up a major broadcast television network, Dungey made her name developing hit shows, but grabbed headlines this year when she canceled Roseanne after the show's star issued a racist tweet. 92. Bill Gurley, age 52, occupation, general partner, Benchmark, previous rank, 31. It's all on Dara. Gurley's firm is one of Silicon Valley's more prolific venture capital concerns, thanks in part to its early bet on Uber. The company is hoping that Khosrow Shahi can stick to his plan and take Uber public next year. 93. Mohammed bin Salman, age 33. Occupation, Crown Prince, Saudi Arabia. And he's new to these rankings. Jared's boy in Riyadh, through his family's $1.4 trillion fortune, MBS has earned audiences with some of the American business community's biggest names, including Google co-founder Sergey Brin, Apple CEO Tim Cook, and Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos, and yes, Jared Kushner. 94. The Groundbreakers, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Ayanna Pressley, Andrew Gillum, Beto O'Rourke, ages 28, 44, 39, and 46, occupations, Democratic hopefuls, and they are new to these rankings. The left's best hope. If Bernie launched the Democratic Socialist Revolution against ossified neoliberalism, these are his successors, avatars of the left's flirtation with universalism and its best attempt to close the enthusiasm gap. When you're dealing with insane people holding the country hostage, you can't go in with your endpoint. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez on the politics of compromise. 95. Arlen Hamilton, age 37. Occupation, founder, Backstage Capital. And she's also new to these rankings. Equity for All. Hamilton's firm aims to rectify Silicon Valley's woeful gender and racial inequality dynamics. She has invested in excess of $4 million in more than 100 companies led by underrepresented founders, and this year she announced a new $36 million fund exclusively to invest in the ventures of black women. 96. Sally Krawcheck, age 53, occupation, CEO, Elevest. And she's also new to these rankings. Disrupting the Street, one of the most senior women on Wall Street, Krawcheck was more or less defenestrated from her big jobs at both Citigroup and Bank of America. She's now the co-founder of one of the largest digital businesses focused entirely on helping women to better invest their money. 97. Audrey Gelman, age 31, occupation, CEO, The Wing, and she's also new to these rankings. Taking Flight, Gelman, Alina Dunham Powell, and former Clinton campaign staffer, is a co-founder. Of the women-only co-working space and social club, The Wing. With 5 locations in 3 cities and about 5,000 members paying up to $3,000 for annual memberships, The Wing is already eyeing international expansion, with planned outposts in London, Paris, and Toronto. 98. Susan Wozitsky. Age, 50. Occupation, CEO YouTube. Previous rank, 81. Not a media company? Long the premier destination for makeup tutorials and iPhone unboxing videos, Wozitsky's YouTube found itself at the epicenter of controversy after the Parkland shooting in early 2018, when the platform inadvertently boosted conspiracy theory videos. Wozitsky has insisted that YouTube isn't a media company. But what is it, then? 99. Anonymous. Occupation, Trump administration senior official, aggrieved op-ed writer, and this person is new to the rankings. A New York Times whodunit. The anonymous author of the most famous opinion piece in recent history not only garnered more than 15 million page views for The Times, but also seized the attention of an audience of one. And number 100, Kylie Jenner, age 21, occupation, founder, Kylie Cosmetics, and she's new to these rankings. Sign of the apocalypse? Thanks to her 100% ownership stake in her eponymous makeup line, Jenner is now worth $900 million. For this list, reporting by Nick Bilton, Maya Kossoff, Joe Pompeo, Gabriel Sherman, William D. Cohan, Abigail Tracy, Emily Jane Fox, Bess Levin, Tina Nguyen, Claire Landsbaum, Ben Landy, Krista Smith, Annalisa Raya, Joy Press, and Rebecca Keegan. Yes, she can. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is preparing to become the youngest member of the House of Representatives. But is the quixotic Bronx Universalist ready for the sharp elbows and sinecures of the swamp? How are you preparing to weigh the urgent desires of your progressive base, such as universal free college education, with the reality that most change in Washington is achieved through incremental compromise? I tend to think that we as a party compromise before we even get to the table. When you're dealing with these insane people holding the country hostage on the right, you can't go in with your end point. You have to go in with a strong position. If they're trying to end Planned Parenthood, I don't think we go in with, no, let's keep Planned Parenthood. I think we go in with, let's expand women's rights to health care and have it guaranteed in every state. I think we can compromise on our tactics and how we get there, but we can't compromise where we're going. As a democratic socialist, what changes are you proposing to your party? I think all of us are committed 1,000% to winning back the House, because frankly, it's existential for the country. Almost every major institution is at stake. We are living in a world where impeachment is a realistic possibility, but in relation to the party, my whole thing is, well, what constitutes the party? Is the party just every elected official? Or every donor? Or is the party every registered Democrat in the United States? I like to think it's the latter. That's where I come from. But a lot of people think the party is the Democratic National Committee or the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. We're going to square up on Medicare for all. There are certain issues where I'm going to make some Democrats mad if they're trying to deliver paydays for Wall Street donors. But that doesn't mean I'm going to burn the house down over it.
Thank you.
Now, here's the November 2018 cover story, The Technicolor Dreams of Michael B. Jordan. Inspired by Wakanda and his newer upbringing, the Black Panther star is building a singular career, equal parts Denzel, Tom Cruise, and Louis B. Mayer. By Joe Hagan. Photographs by Cass Bird. Styled by Samira Nasser. Opening photo, Made in the Shade, Michael B. Jordan, photographed in East Hampton, New York. And in this photo, he's dressed in a suit, sneakers, and is lying on the grass. It's right around the time I'm prattling on about racial diversity in Hollywood that Michael B. Jordan, the movie star, floors the gas pedal and sends his blade-like sports car ripping down the Pacific Coast Highway, a fast forward jolt that turns Malibu into a kinetic blur of pink and blue. "Oh, Jesus Christ," I cry out. I grip the armrest and see terrible visions of us slicing a beach bum in half as he accidentally stumbles into the road, or exploding into that white van that looks to be edging unexpectedly into our lane. "I got you," Jordan assures over the engine roar. When he finally slows, imagine the Millennium Falcon after hyperspace, he turns to me and flashes that winning Michael B. Jordan smile, a dazzling display of superstar teeth that sends 7.3 million Instagram followers into squeals of delight. "You're so hot, baby," a nervous laugh catches in my throat. A minute later, Jordan does it again. "We're at 100 right now," he mentions, cutting left to avoid a car. 110. Me. "Oh, shit." His oversized sports jersey says "Fear of God" on it. It's quite a rush, but for a split second, it does cross my mind that Jordan is unnecessarily tempting fate. What if we kill somebody? What if we're pulled over for reckless driving? A black man doing, let's see, 127 miles per hour at 4 in the afternoon in lily-white Malibu? More is being risked here than our necks, something that Michael Bakari Jordan, of all people, is equipped to understand. Jordan was the star of Fruitvale Station, the 2013 breakout indie hit directed by Ryan Coogler, in which Jordan played Oscar Grant, the real-life black youth gunned down by a transit cop in 2009 for a lot less than speeding. Jordan himself says that after a few years before, he was racially profiled, stopped for alleged speeding, and got searched, handcuffed, and detained on South La Brea Avenue. He informed the officer he was late for a flight at LAX. "I think I might have said something slick," says Jordan, "'cause it was the end of the month. I was like, oh, you guys trying to meet a quota." I said something like that. That probably didn't help me at all. By the time the cop let him off, without a ticket, Jordan had missed his flight. At the time, he was starring in Red Tails, the George Lucas movie about black fighter pilots. When Jordan finally gears down, we look at each other and laugh. A lot just happened, and then it dawns on me. In rocketing down the Pacific Coast Highway and freaking out the white rider from Vanity Fair, Michael B. Jordan had just turned a theoretical conversation about race into a palpable theater that requires no words at all. This might be the most optimistic time in history for black artists in Hollywood, and Jordan, who starred as the villain Killmonger in Black Panther, an urban anti-hero who smolders with sex appeal, has become its most distinct leading man. As his co-star in Fruitvale Station, the actress Melanie Diaz told me, "This is our time. This is our time to be leading men and leading ladies." How does that feel? I think Mike gets that. Jordan has declared that he wants to advance the cultural aims of black people on film. He also wants to become a matinee idol on par with Leonardo DiCaprio or Matt Damon, which means he wants the ultimate kind of racial equity, to be a movie star, full stop. I'm first and foremost a black man, for sure, but what I'm trying to do and what I'm trying to represent and build is universal, he says. We live in the times where everything is based around race, he says, and for me it's like, I get it, I understand. It just makes everything so loaded. When the way to do it is to Trojan horse it, so then people look up and say, oh wow, what happened? I didn't even realize that. On the surface, Jordan's two goals might seem incompatible, to be both black and not black. But Jordan's biggest films to date, both directed by 32-year-old Coogler, have cannily achieved a parity between racial advancement and Hollywood entertainment. Creed, which flipped the script on Rocky by putting a black boxing hero at the top of a traditionally white franchise, and Black Panther, which embedded an almost entirely black cast and Afrocentric themes in a tableau of Marvel Comics superheroics. This Sunday afternoon in Malibu, on a trip to a burger joint up the coast, perhaps the real point is the car, an Acura NSX, a stunning white objet d'art with a low, sleek, sci-fi design. I couldn't figure out how to open the door, and a window in back for viewing the turbo engine. The nearly $160,000 machine is part of an endorsement deal Jordan cut with Acura, an arrangement orchestrated by Philip Sun, his agent at William Morris Endeavor, after the first Creed movie in 2015, wherein Jordan played Adonis, the illegitimate son of boxer Apollo Creed, and Sylvester Stallone played the aging Rocky Balboa. The car is a dream come true for a kid from Newark who used to race illegally with friends in high school and obsess over this very model while his devoted and politically aware parents toiled in a small catering business, while ferrying him to modeling gigs and plotting his future in a hostile world. Built on this hard-won foundation, Jordan is aiming for breathtaking heights. His ambition is to be not only an actor, but a one-man movie studio whose every move has a dollar sign attached to it and for whom nothing is left to chance. With multi-million dollar endorsement deals, his own production company, and a new marketing and consulting startup in the works, he's applying the old Jay-Z adage, I'm not a businessman, I am a business man, to the business of movie making. He knows exactly what he is, which is a commodity, says Tessa Thompson, his co-star in Creed II, the new sequel. Then be owner of it, really and truly. It's a lot of pressure on a 31-year-old whose journey isn't just his own. An entire community is depending on this particular commodity. His parents and siblings and an ever-growing entourage of advisors, friends, and consultants. Not to mention the black actors, writers, and directors cheering his success, because it is theirs as well. His agent is casting him as the Tom Cruise of his generation. His publicists are campaigning for an Oscar for his role in Black Panther. He could go all the way, or the whole thing could blow up, and not only at 127 miles an hour. The first time I see Michael B. Jordan, he's playing a demonstration game of air hockey in a gigantic arcade in a Hollywood mall. Jordan hosts a yearly fundraiser called the MB Jam, selling tickets to fans and bringing in celebrity friends to draw attention to lupus, the chronic autoimmune disease his mother, Donna, suffers from. Next photos. On the horizon, Jordan says his upbringing has influenced many of his roles. And he's pictured here with the ocean in the background, and we do see the horizon behind him. and Full Court Press, Jordan on Louse Point, with a 1972 Chevrolet El Camino, at rest and play in East Hampton. His entire inner circle is here, high school friends and movie industry pals, his agent, his agent's assistant, his high-powered publicist, his publicist assistant, his personal assistant, siblings, cousins, aunts, uncles, and of course his parents. Jordan, in an olive-green satin bomber jacket and designer sweats, does a photo shoot for Coach, his latest endorsement deal, and an interview with E! Channel, with his mother by his side. Jamie Foxx shows up for the photo splash. Lena Waithe gives an interview. It's a family affair. When Jordan goes home, his family goes with him to Sherman Oaks, where his parents and younger brother Khalid, a Howard University grad who works in development at Warner Horizon Television, lives with him in a mansion he purchased in 2016. In part, it's to care for his mother, but also because his parents remain deeply engaged in his career and life. When he holds business meetings at the house, his father will come in with a plate of sandwiches. There are portraits of Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, and Marcus Garvey on the walls, and bookshelves filled with black history and literature, most of it belonging to his father. His mother's artwork, large, multicolored impressionistic paintings, hang on the wall. Donna Jordan, an elegant woman in her 60s, who wears an African print dress and her close-cropped hair dyed sunflower yellow, is a classic stage mom. She casually calls me baby doll. Her son's career began at her doctor's office when the receptionist suggested she get her 11-year-old into modeling. "I was just, at the time, thinking about college tuition and that sort of thing," Donna Jordan says. "Little did I know that it was going to be job after job after job after job." A sweetly introverted geek who obsessed over anime, comic books, sci-fi films, and the New York Knicks, Jordan modeled for Kmart and Toys R Us before landing a bit role in the Cosby Show revival in 2000. Jordan's main memory of Bill Cosby is the aging star asking him to practice brushing his hair for a scene. Cosby didn't let him stop brushing for an entire afternoon until Jordan's scalp was raw and burning. Needless to say, it gave Jordan a dim view of acting. As Jordan summed up his attitude in an early interview, F that. Jordan's first big role was as Wallace on HBO's The Wire, a child gang member who is killed by an older friend after he witnesses a murder and becomes a liability to his crew, the Barksdale organization. Jordan was 15 years old, doe-eyed, cornrows in his hair, with a wounded glower that could break unexpectedly into a room-altering smile. His mother wept when she watched the death scene. Jordan was hardly an actor, not even a school play to his name, but his unformed screen presence was exactly what writer-producer David Simon was after. Veteran actors like Andre Royo, who played the street junkie Bubbles, took Jordan under their wing, showing him, for instance, how to act like he was high on drugs. "He came to me, little young kid, but just eager to learn, with like, 'Hey, Dre, you mind giving me some pointers? You think you can help me out with this?' And I was kind of laughing to myself, like, 'I hope he's ready.'" The Wire was not an immediate hit, but Jordan's ambitions were ignited by the attention. Maybe he could be the next Will Smith. He took out his cornrows and declared that he was through being typecast. His first film role, a year before The Wire, had been as a Chicago street urchin named Jamal in Hardball, a feel-good comedy drama about a group of hard-knocks black kids converted into a baseball team by a white coach, played by Keanu Reeves. "With the braids out, I should have more options," Jordan said at the time. I'm being thrown urban roles right now, but I don't plan on doing these my whole life. Next photo, fast forward. Jordan's business endeavors include a production company and a marketing operation. And in the photo, he's riding a bike. And that is a bicycle. Soon after, he was typecast again as Reggie, a troubled teen in the ABC soap opera All My Children, what he later called an effing stereotypical black role. But it did give him a 4-year contract and more training as an actor, not to mention an income. When Jordan's role in All My Children wrapped in 2006, he was 19 and had decided to move to Los Angeles and pursue a career. A family friend, Sterling Stilo Brim, whom Jordan met on the set of Hardball, joined him, and the two scratched for work. Jordan would spend the next few years trying to find roles that suited his ambitions, but Hollywood at that point had precious little bandwidth for rising black superstars. I remember when I first came to L.A., and me and my mom, we went to all these agencies trying to get representation, and they passed on me. WME passed on me. CAA passed on me. Gersh, all these guys effing passed on me, says Jordan. He says it gave him a healthy chip on his shoulder. So did his name, which was never going to be his alone. Jordan was a rent check away from packing it in when he ran into Andre Royo at a pool party in Los Angeles, hosted by The Wire director Anthony Hemingway. He was stressed out, recounts Royo, 50. He was like, yo, I'm not working enough. Shit is crazy. I think I'm going to go back to New York. And he was really on some boo-hoo shit. And I was like, yo, dog, are you kidding me right now? You in your early 20s, and you're around MFs trying to feed families who ain't working. Snap out of it. Jordan's career was going sideways when producer Peter Berg cast him as quarterback Vince Howard in NBC's Friday Night Lights. Jordan spent 2 seasons as the hard-luck troublemaker who overcomes his demons to help win the championship, throwing a Hail Mary pass in the final play. It was Jordan's most complex and richly drawn role to date, and his cocked eyebrow, easy smile, and rangy sex appeal seemed to pop on the screen. Friday Night Lights quickly became his calling card, leading to a role as a benevolent teenager named Alex for 2 seasons of Parenthood on NBC. As Steve in the teenage sci-fi thriller Chronicle, directed by Josh Trank, and crucially a role in Red Tails, the George Lucas-produced historical account of the Tuskegee Airmen of World War II, a squadron of African-American fighter pilots. Jordan was disappointed that his best scene was cut from Red Tails, and the movie was a commercial and critical flop. But Jordan stood out in a cast of top black actors, including Cuba Gooding Jr. and Terrence Howard, and it led to offers of roles in potential blockbuster franchises, including Fantastic Four. Jordan took the Fantastic Four role as the Human Torch, a controversial casting decision because the Human Torch was originally a white character. To quell fan uproar, Jordan published a personal essay entitled Why I'm Torching the Color Line. The movie, also directed by Josh Trank, seemed like Jordan's ticket to the big time, but it was destined to flop badly, nearly damaging Jordan's career. Before Fantastic Four even hit theaters, however, 2 fateful events would change everything for Jordan. On the advice of his agent, he had taken a meeting at Starbucks with a hugely ambitious but untested new director named Ryan Coogler, who had ideas for a gritty indie film called Fruitvale Station and a Blue Sky project to revive the Rocky franchise with a black leading man. And just as Fruitvale emerged in 2013, a self-styled vigilante named George Zimmerman was found innocent in the killing of Trayvon Martin, a black teenager in Florida, sparking the Black Lives Matter movement. Fruitvale Station is about the last 24 hours in the life of Oscar Grant, a 22-year-old from Oakland who was senselessly shot by a transit cop on a train platform on New Year's Day in 2009. Before Jordan filmed the final scene at Fruitvale Station in the BART subway system in San Francisco, Coogler led the cast and crew in a group prayer while Jordan lay on the exact same spot where Grant died. "The bullet mark was still there," Jordan recalls. "I was right on top of it, exactly where he was at." Fruitvale was a powerful piece of political art, perfectly pitched to its moment. Jordan's method acting became legend. He moved to Oakland 1 month before shooting to retrace Grant's steps and spend time with Grant's family and friends, keeping detailed notebooks to help him fully realize his character and immersing himself to the point where some people didn't know where Oscar Grant ended and Jordan began. When Coogler met Jordan, the two bonded instantly as millennials who loved Jay-Z and the Brazilian indie film City of God, but also as young men from predominantly black cities, Oakland and Newark, situated across bodies of water from major metropolises. You get inspired. The possibilities, the dreams, what opportunities are over there, says Jordan. It gives you this hunger to get across the water, across the bridge, across the tunnel, to the other place. Coogler, the son of a community organizer and a probation officer, had spent a year and a half trying to persuade Sylvester Stallone to entrust him with the Rocky franchise and extend the 6-movie storyline with the tale of Adonis Creed, the illegitimate son of Apollo, Rocky's one-time nemesis and later best friend, who died in Rocky IV at the hands of a Russian combatant played by Dolph Lundgren. It was Stallone's wife, Jennifer, who finally convinced her husband to do it. Preparing for Creed required Jordan to live like a monk, training 6 days a week to chisel his body into that of a credible middleweight boxer. His abs became part of his newfound profile as an actor, as did a newly charged idea of black political consciousness. He dressed up like Malcolm X for a GQ fashion spread. Fruitvale and Creed forged the relationship between Coogler and Jordan, and the two were now viewed as a package. With Black Panther, Marvel Studios gave Coogler the firepower to shatter the preconception of what a black film could do. A $200 million budget. By contrast, Fruitvale Station cost $900,000. Coogler co-wrote the screenplay, including the final scene in which Jordan, as Killmonger, is felled by a sword and spends his dying moments, lips quivering, eyes welling with tears. Gazing out over the Afro-futuristic utopia of Wakanda, declaring, "It's beautiful." In a nod to black history that is also a powerful slice of cinematic melodrama, Killmonger asked King T'Challa, Black Panther, to bury me in the ocean with my ancestors that jumped from the ships because they knew death was better than bondage. The film has grossed $1.3 billion worldwide. Next photo, making waves, Jordan at Laos Point. The film has grossed $1.3 billion worldwide. Last spring at the Met Gala in New York, Michael B. Jordan arrived in a ninja-style pinstriped suit with a black belt hanging down like a panther tail, created by the first-ever black menswear designer at Louis Vuitton, Virgil Abloh. Amid the red carpet flash bulbs and avant-garde couture, the new faces of a black renaissance found one another in the crowd and posed for an impromptu group photograph, with Jordan standing among Janelle Monáe, Daniel Kaluuya, Tessa Thompson, Lena Waithe, John Boyega, Cynthia Erivo, Chadwick Boseman, and Letitia Wright. In a year when the top movie was Black Panther, the best show on television, Atlanta, was about characters orbiting a black hip-hop artist. And a real-life hip-hop artist, Kendrick Lamar, won the Pulitzer Prize. The picture felt like a gate crashing and a cultural watershed. Afterward, the group converged at the Up and Down Club in downtown Manhattan and marveled at their moment. Jordan looked at me and he was like, "We got to keep going. We have to keep going," recounts Lena Waithe, the creator of Showtime's The Chi. I said, "I don't got no plans of stopping." After the gala, Jordan posted a picture of himself on Instagram, standing next to Donald Glover, the creator and star of Atlanta, with the caption, "Synergy. Me and Donald, we got some things brewing also," Jordan tells me. "Timing is right, you know." Stephen Caple Jr., the director of Jordan's next film, Creed II, calls this moment of black solidarity in Hollywood a movement. During the filming last March, Jordan and Caple often talked about black historical figures whose stories might make a great movie or TV series, like Fred Hampton, the Black Panther who was murdered in his apartment in 1969, or Mansa Musa, a Malian historical figure of the 14th century, known to many African Americans but virtually unknown to white people. Musa was reputedly one of the richest men in the world. "When people look at black people, it's hard for them to think beyond slavery," says Caple. "We don't have any mythology, black mythology or folklore," Jordan explains to me as we cruise past billboards for Atlanta and HBO's Ballers in West Hollywood. DJ Khaled's I'm the One is on the car stereo, and I notice Jordan's iPhone alias is Bruce Leroy, the black martial arts hero of the 1985 film The Last Dragon. "Creating our own mythology is very important because it helps dream," says Jordan. "You help people dream." While promoting Fantastic Four, Jordan came out of the box with a rough-hewn ghetto biography that could have been a backstory from The Wire. "I'm from North Jersey, bro," he told GQ. "I come from nothing. I come from sleeping in the kitchen with my family with the oven open to keep us warm during winter, you know." With the GQ reporter tagging along, Jordan becomes incensed when a maitre d' at a restaurant makes him wait too long for a table, then sticks gum under the table to avenge the perceived racial slight, and then gets drunk on tequila cocktails. "My home, growing up," he said of his neighborhood in Newark, "is hood as F." His mother, Donna, was none too pleased. "It was so crass," she says now, "a little embellished. Actor's license." "The hood was the hood," she says, sighing. "Yes, when we got up in the morning, there was possibly crack vials and condoms on the street. The hood was around us, and it was the hood, but our experience was different." Jordan says his parents didn't witness everything he did, getting held up at gunpoint, or seeing a crime scene, which was normal for Newark, he says. But he regrets his early braggadocio and chalks it up to wounded pride. In truth, Jordan was mostly shielded from the blunt end of Newark, because his parents worked for years to build their own version of Wakanda out of the dregs of urban decay. Jordan's parents thought deeply about the optimal strategy for African Americans to survive and prosper on a field that was heavily tilted against them. Jordan was born during the crack epidemic of the late 1980s, when George H.W. Bush was campaigning for president partly by inciting racist fears with the infamous Willie Horton ad. Newark had one of the highest crime rates in the country. But Jordan's parents plugged their children into a close-knit, Afrocentric community that was a version of the aspirational Cosby world, one that had evolved from the black nationalism and self-empowerment politics of the 1960s. In real terms, it meant a loose network of black churches, black schools, black political organizations, black-owned newspapers, and black clubs. Jordan's was the kind of insular and conservative upbringing that Ta-Nehisi Coates, in his 2009 profile of Michelle Obama for The Atlantic, called a functioning, self-contained African-American world. "We helicoptered them," says Donna of her three children. "They were not out of our grasp at all. We orchestrated everything." "They were always having sleepovers and having people come over and cooking," says her son. "My house was the house. You would get a great meal and play basketball outside, or video games, or watch a movie." When Jordan was growing up, his father would regularly dispense nuggets of liberation philosophy and black history to his children, citing canonical books on the African diaspora like The Destruction of Black Civilization by Chancellor Williams, Stolen Legacy by George G.M. James, or Ethiopia and the Missing Link in African History by the Reverend Sterling Means. "Whenever I would go by the dining room, he'd always be reading," says Michael B. Jordan. "My dad was very adamant about educating himself and giving us a sense of identity and to understand where we come from. And it's not everything that's taught in the history books, in the school books." Jordan's budding acting career was a source of pride in the Clinton Hill neighborhood of Newark, and for his family, a source of income. By the time Michael B. Jordan was acting in The Wire, his father had quit his job working nights as a supervisor at John F. Kennedy Airport to start an independent catering business, beginning with lunches at Jordan's Junior High, a tuition-based private school called CHAD, founded by the Black Youth Organization in the 1960s. With an emphasis on Afrocentrism and black pride, Donna worked as a kind of social worker at CHAD, helping poor families navigate the system, and Jordan and his two siblings, Khalid and Jamila, also attended. His parents remain on the board of directors. Jordan's mother grew up in Newark in the 60s and 70s, studying painting at Newark Arts High, the first performing arts public high school in America, whose alumni include Sarah Vaughan, Wayne Shorter, and Savion Glover, and later Michael B. Jordan, who attended for 2 years. As a teenager, she painted her bedroom walls in the colors of the Pan-African flag, red, black, and green, in sympathy with the Committee for a Unified Newark, a black nationalist group founded by poet Amiri Baraka. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service and broadcasting from its Raleigh, North Carolina studios. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.